Hi, I'm Vera. I'm an alcoholic. I think it's interesting, Joe said, I really want the Al-Anoners to speak to me throughout the conference. He said that he feels really uncomfortable when he came up here. You know, my very first conference was the ORC, and it was, in a sense, officially my first AA meeting. And I wasn't even sure I was an alcoholic, but I was already sitting in the back seat there, ready to bolt, but at the same time thinking, I could do that talk better than that person. I want to be up there and tell my story. So, I mean, I think that, is that not an alcoholic trait? I would really like people to tell me later what they think. Okay, so my name is Vera. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is September 21st, 2008, and I am a member of St. Clemens in Toronto.
Thank you.
I'm here after 4 years of sobriety in the program, but it isn't the first time that I've had a kick at the can at sobriety. I've sort of been doing this for quite a while. Outside of the program. So in a way, I think that one of the messages that I'd like to convey is the difference between being sober out there and the difference from being sober in here. And really, it is like night and day. that's a large part of my story. The first time that I knew that I had to stop drinking was when I was around 23 years old and I was in university. I've always been struggling with whether I'm an alcoholic or not, because I could always stop. And I didn't really understand the whole dynamic about that there's other things, that alcohol is just the thing, the symptom, but not the problem, until much later. So I really struggled with that, because I came from a background where my mother was an alcoholic. And she was the kind where it was really obvious that she was an alcoholic. She was the sort that I didn't know when I came home if she'd be passed out in bed or on the floor or lost somewhere in the streets or the police would be there. I mean, it was all drama and it was all, the classic story of alcohol. And I never lived that kind of life. I didn't have that kind of experience. So I had that as a background and... I don't think that's not me. But I knew that I had to stop drinking by the time I was 23 years old because I was in university in my third year or something like that. And I was completely isolated. I had isolated myself entirely by my own doing because I had moved to the town of Windsor, which is, a bit of a hard place to live if anyone's been there. Oh, sorry, there may be somebody here. It's a great place. Sorry. I tried to figure out how can I can. It's so hard when you're this age to condense a lot of it into a half an hour. So. I had isolated myself because. Well, here I was in residence. I had managed to get into residence. And the people that were there, they were all drinkers too, but they drank sort of with their parties, the sororities, the baseball games, the big parties. And I didn't really see the point of the ball and the throwing and all that kind of stuff. To me, it was just about getting high. And when I would drink with my buddies, it was... I often think of it as, like when you're in a school, I think it's 3 or 4 year olds, they are in a crowd with people, with other kids, but they're not really playing with each other. They're there, they like each other, but everyone's in their own little world. And drinking with, or partying with my friends was, you get together to talk about what you're going to do, what kind of music is going to be played, and then everyone just retreats into their own thing. And over time, I just took out that element and just did my own thing. Had my own party in my head and did like a lot of fantasy where I was the star of whatever fantasy I had. And so I didn't have my buddies with me and the university crowd that I was with, I didn't like them, so I ended up being by myself. So there I was. I'm going to tell you sort of one particular event. I guess it was more like the... emotional bottom. It wasn't the actual bottom, but the emotional one, where I'm laying there, I wake up in the morning, and I had put with black magic marker over the door frame of my room, really large, from some night of, I don't know what, God is dead. It was something that Nietzsche wrote. And I just thought that was such a cool thing to have. And, I mean, that was the kind of thing I thought was really cool. But it meant that whenever I woke up, that's what I was looking at. God is dead. And it was really, really, like, depressing. One of the things about alcohol that I found, and I have to say I liked the whole thing, but it was weird in a way, was that the first few drinks were always fun and giddy and exciting, and I liked that. And then the second sort of set of 3 to 6 or something like that, I'm starting to stumble and get thick in the mouth and fall over, but I still think that's fun. And then the next phase is the getting depressed and really funky or skunky, and I want to play music like Jimi Hendrix and the Doors and you know, the whole suicide, you know, dark, that was kind of fun too. But I really got into the whole cutting and slashing thing, and I mean, I had these things which I called my red badges of courage. It was this whole thing which, of course, these other university students just thought, she's weird. And I just thought, you know, like, Zhao, they're boring. Yeah, we can relate. So anyway, there I was alone, and I think it was, I was starting, I actually failed a couple of courses, and I was a very ambitious person, and that just really, anyway, something told me I have to stop drinking. I really should stop. And the people that I had hung out with before I went into university were already going to AA, and one of them actually said to me, guess what, you know, I'm going to AA, come to my medallion. And I thought, well, AA, okay, I'll come to your medallion, but I don't really need to, just, all right, I'll do it to support you. Now, this is somebody that I knew, and she was a friend of mine, a real drinking, well, she was more than that, she was like a friend. When I was about 17 years old, my mother had already died from alcoholism, and I was just living with my father, and we did not get along. So I left for the sort of brave new world of excitement. I had no friends until then. I was a very weird, see, I guess I was always a weird kid. I was very strange. I didn't have any social skills. I'll just put it to that. I didn't have any social skills. When I was 14 years old, people would, you know, the girls, that was the age when they were starting to notice boys and talk about kissing them and you know, makeup and stuff like that. And I didn't want to tell them. I was still playing with my dolls at home. They were G.I. Joes. But and cowboys, but they were you know, wasn't talking about boys and makeup and all that sort of stuff. So I was really quite isolated. So when I left home, I sort of found this crowd of people. You know, I went to a hostel, and then I ended up going into some kind of shelter, and then I ended up in a treatment center where it was really just a place to live for a while. I mean, we were supposed to get better, but all of us, it was just a place to crash. And that was in the 70s when treatment centers were, I think that they're different now. I mean, I work at a couple of them now, and I don't think it's like this now, but they were really just places to live and party whenever the staff weren't paying attention. I think things were just a lot more liberal then. And it was Detroit, near Detroit, and yeah, you can just imagine. So I got to know lots of people, and I mean, the level of social interaction and social skills that we needed was just, you know, what are we going to do tonight? Where are you going to get it? How are we going to get around staff so-and-so? I mean, it was very simple. Very simple. And then once we all did our thing, you didn't have to talk to him, and you just retreated into yourself. So I didn't have to learn social skills. When I was 23, I thought, okay, I got to stop all of this. I didn't want to go back to my friends, but I went to this AA meeting, as I said a minute ago. So I went into this AA meeting. I knew I wanted to change my life in some way. And I had that reaction that probably many of you had, which was, oh my God, those slogans. Ooh. I'm in university, you know. I just finished reading Nietzsche, God is dead. Easy does it, just doesn't go with this picture. People were laughing, and I just thought that was just, you know, I wanted to be serious and hardworking, and it just didn't jive. So I just said, okay, you do what you do, I'm going to do my thing. And I attributed it then to being German. Now I think it's just being alcoholic. I don't know. I liked rules. I love rules. I wanted to set the rules up of my self-improvement program. This was my own self-improvement program. I love rules as long as they're mine and not yours. And I really love it if I can make my rules your rules, but I don't want to follow your rules. So I did my rules, and I essentially did my rules for the next 20 to 30 years, where I thought, okay, I'm going to stop drinking. And what I ended up doing, this was completely to my surprise. I don't know what I would have done if I'd known ahead of time, but I found that I would just do other things instead. I didn't know that when you put down the drink, you got to deal with yourself. Well, I knew I had to deal with myself, but I didn't know how to do that other than to find something else. And so at various times I would, I don't know, find other drugs. But mostly what ended up happening, because of just the way school got into the way things happened, I ended up just not drinking and then slowly eating more and eating more and eating more. And then what I found was this kind of continuum over my life, the next 20 to 30 years, where there was alcohol on this end and food on this end. And if I didn't drink at all, I ate. And if I didn't eat at all, I'd want to drink. And I kind of figured out somewhere in there, that's what happened. So Vera, if you can just kind of do it in the middle. And the magic solution for me was, 3 or 4 drinks to get that happy buzz, and then before I get into the sloppy, I'd eat instead. And the kind of eating, I'm not just talking about a few chocolate bars, I'm talking about a few chocolate bars and throwing them up, and then a few more and throwing them up, and eventually developing a bulimic combo, alcohol combo, which worked really well. Because I wasn't an alcoholic. I stopped drinking after 2 or 3 drinks. That's acceptable. And I didn't tell people about the other stuff because that was just really embarrassing. And when I went out in the world and actually got into this field, it was fine. How much do you drink? A couple of drinks a night, no problem. Or not necessarily a night if I was just doing the food thing. Like, it looked good on the outside, sort of. Anyway, what ended up happening was, about 10 years ago, 100 pounds more than I am now, I decided, okay, this is not working, because even though it was kind of working externally, I got my achievements, I got my degree, I got my job, all this kind of stuff, I was still, aching, hurting, wanting. That hadn't been touched at all. So I decided I have to stop eating and I have to stop drinking. So that was about 8 or 9 years ago where I did stop both. So I kind of stopped that continuum thing that I had been doing for 20 or 30 years. And then I started doing, I knew, okay, now I have to live. How do I live with Vera? So in a sense, I knew about AA, but it was still something, you know, I stopped drinking. So I don't belong there, so I'm not going to go. I'm going to do other things. So I ended up doing all sorts of stuff that's out there sort of in terms of outside help. You know, I did hypnosis, I did cognitive therapy, I did just regular therapy, gestalt therapy, a million courses in self-improvement. I did actually learn, I don't know how well, but I did actually learn how to get some social skills. I read books like the Dale Carnegie book, and it's like, oh, that's how you talk to people. Wow. It's just really fascinating. I'm serious about that. Anyway, that actually held me for a couple of years. I started to get into the spirituality stuff. I mean, at first I thought it was hokey, and then I thought, oh, okay, maybe there's something to that. But it didn't hold me for very long. what ended up, I guess the image that I want to give, and this is what brought me to the program, is there's this philosophy called Spartan. It's a Greek ancient philosophy called Spartan philosophy. And the sort of image of the Spartan is the person who's like the soldier, who can just go through life no matter what. And I remember when I read about that in my history class, I thought, oh, that, I like that image. And the classic image was, even if the fox is eating the entrails, your entrails, you're still, I'm okay. And I felt like at the end of that 4 years, the fox was eating my entrails, and I could no longer say I was okay. You know, I had the wife, I had the house, I had the job, I had the whatever, the car, whatever, but the fox was eating the entrails, and I really just did not care. And so I thought at that point, well, I got a choice. I could kill myself, or I could drink again. And so I drank again. And I remember that first night and the number of nights after when I was drinking, I would, I had that continuum before of happy, happy, kind of sloppy, and then depressed. I went right to the depressed, which was okay. That was, I remember I was laying by the toilet, you know, throwing up, because alcohol always made me throw up, and thinking, I'm really, really sick. I'm really throwing up. I knew this would happen. I mean, I knew this would happen. But you know what? I still like this better than being sober the way I was. As ugly as it feels, it's a kind of ugly I don't mind compared to that cold, ugly, cold sobriety of that fox eating the entrails. I didn't want that. And often my remember when now, when I think about things in the program, are not so much the horrible things that happened or the depression or it's mostly depression then anxiety that I went through in my drinking. It's either that or it was that horrible feeling of being sober and hating it. So there I was. I had relapsed. This is almost 5 years ago now. And I knew that even though I didn't care on one level, I mean, I still had the practical world to deal with. And I had gotten myself into enough trouble that was going to jeopardize my work. So I thought, okay, I better get some help. But I don't know how to do it, because I've been doing it for the last 20 years with my sort of alcohol food thing, and that wasn't working. So I thought, okay, I'll go to Al-Anon. Because I'm not an alcoholic, but I am. I qualify for Al-Anon. I had a mother who she died of her alcoholism, and our whole life revolved around her, the drama of her and her death. So I certainly qualified. But every time I went to an Al-Anon meeting, I bolted after 10 minutes. I just could not stay inside a meeting. Every time, the moment somebody started talking, and I feel this way still today, the moment somebody starts talking about anything remotely about that alcoholic and what they did to them, I'm ready to stand up and want to go out and drink, because I'm looking at their pain and I'm feeling their pain, and I can't feel their pain, and I still feel that way. And I got to say, for those of you who are successful Al-Anonics, great. I mean, I think that's I admire the bravery of that. I'm not being silly, because I can't do it. I can't do it yet. That is something that is it's progress, not perfection. That's something down the line. I even tried about 3 months ago, and I bolted from that meeting. I lasted about 15 minutes, and they were just doing the readings. Oh God! They're just doing the readings. Anyway, so I went to the Al-Anon meeting, didn't work. I got that, and then there was the ORC. So I thought, an ORC meeting, that's going to be a good one, because it's going to be a lot of people and it'll be safe. Lasted about 5 minutes, was running out, crying, ran by the AA thing that was just the open meeting was coming in. I thought, oh, well, why don't I just look at it, check it out? I don't really belong, but nobody will mind. I'll just say it's an open meeting. So I went and I sat in the back seat. And I immediately felt a sense of, this is one of those, I hear many people talk about this, just magic moments where the moment I sat down, people are laughing, I see the slogans, it doesn't matter, I just feel safe. It was like something had muzzled that fox that was eating the entrails. I knew the fox was still there. I could still feel the anxiety churning. But for that particular moment, sitting there, they hadn't even started speaking yet. I felt safe. And I have not lost that feeling. And if I don't go to, I go to four meetings a week at least. And if I miss one or two, it starts to come back. I don't know what that's about, but nevertheless, I'm happy to go to meetings because that's essentially my medicine. So I went to, how much time do I have? I don't want to go over. About 15 minutes or so? Yeah, okay. Okay, so that's how I got here, through Al-Anon. So I sat in this meeting, and then I thought, okay, well, I really liked what they had to say. As I said, I was already thinking about a better speech I would give. But I still managed to hear what the person said, and I thought, boy, I can really relate to this. And the whole point was is I could listen to it. There was no sense of bolting. In fact, I was melting into it. It was like I had found, I've said it in many different ways, like I was, you know, finally peeing my pants and, oh, God, thank you. I finally have to go. Good. Or, you know, melting into my mother's arms. I don't know. Anyway, whatever it was, it felt safe and it felt like relief. So I kept going to meetings just for that feeling. It was like, or drinking from a bottle. Drinking from, I'm thinking about a baby bottle. But, you know, that just that comforting feeling. Every time somebody would speak, it would be like I was chugging down more of like milk from a bottle. So I wasn't entirely wanting to get sober because I'd had that horrible experience and I didn't want to, it really left a bad taste in my mouth. So it took me about 6 months to actually commit. And it was a commitment of, okay, I have to, shit, all right, I will. I'll give it a year and I'll try it, but I don't want to. And in that process, I got a sponsor. I mean, in that 6 months that I was in the program, I went through two sponsors who had had enough of my waffling back and forth. But finally, I got somebody who was pretty strong-minded and I guess just said, do it or don't. So well, we started to work the steps, which I thought, okay, that's like therapy. I've done therapy. No problem. I can do this. And so we did the fourth. Something really, really important happened to me. I mean, I started to see the program working on a non-intellectual level. So here I am, I'm doing something which looks to me an awful lot like therapy. I can just give you one example of something that I had to work on my fourth step. And that was basically saying no to somebody that in my life that was really, really a big drain on me. And this is somebody who'd been in my life for about 10 years and was a tremendous drain. Every time they wanted something, I should have said no, but I couldn't. And then I got more entrenched, and they wanted more, and I would give more, and I'd resent it. And it was just this horrible situation of just, I should just say no, but I couldn't. And it got really messy. So in my therapy, which I had done for many years, I would tell this story and the person would say, okay, well then next week you're going to say no and tell me what it's like. And then the next week I would come and say, I know I should have said no, but I didn't. Well, then next week you'll do it. Same thing. I know I should have, but I didn't. And then we would spend the next 3 months talking about all the obstacles, about why I couldn't say no and what was wrong with my ability to say no. And then I'd know that, but I still couldn't say no. And then we would look at all sorts of the different angles of what it was about her and me. And what, anyway, after like 3 years, I still hadn't said no. This was therapy that I was paying for. Then I did my fourth step, and over the course of the weekend, it was a Friday night, I said, okay, there's this thing, it's a resentment that I have, I can't say no, and this person keeps bugging me, and my sponsor said, well, say no, and I said, well, I can't, let me explain to you why. I got all the reasons down. And he said, no, I don't need to hear the examples. Just do it. And I said, no, you don't understand my problem. Let me explain to you. I have lots of years of explanation here. and he just cut it short and said, is this working for you? And I said, no, it's not. And he said, is this going to affect your sobriety? And, if it meant going back to that kind of sobriety that I had, and or if it meant drinking, which was going to kill me, yes, it affected my sobriety. He said, so do it. So I just thought, okay, he said, do it. Now, I had already done my way for I don't know how many therapy sessions, that wasn't working. So without even thinking, it was like I had to just don't think, Vera, for the night, don't think. I was going to meet her the next morning, and then that next morning I went and I saw her and I said, goodbye, that's it. And I turned around and I walked away. Oh my God. And as I walked away, I had that flood of relief, and I thought to myself, do I regret that I said this in a way that wasn't very nice and pleasant, and I didn't understand her, and listen to her side of the story? Well, maybe a little bit, but oh my God, the bigger regret was, why didn't I do that 4 years ago, 8 years ago? And I just concluded, you know, this program has given me what I could not do for myself. It told me to stop thinking and just bloody do it. Listening to the direction of somebody else. It made such a difference, not just to that scenario, because now I had this person who took a chunk of my mental anguish out of my day, but also the ability to know I can say no, and actually, I don't even care. Well, I sort of care what happened to her, but not enough to find out. I haven't even Facebooked her. Okay. So you know, that's one example of what AA has done for me and what I did. And another thing my sponsor did in that first year is he said, like Joe, I am a very private person. He said, I want you to phone 3 people every day. And I said, no, you don't understand. I don't like the phone. I do not like that. I got a phobic thing about the phone. Like, I actually, like, get shaky and sweats if I have to phone, if I think about it for too long. It's kind of like a needle. If you do it quick, you don't notice. But if you think about it, panic attack. So I said, I can't do it. And he said, again, well, you know, how's that working for you, Vera? So I said, okay, I'm not going to think, I'm just going to do this. I did manage to get 2 people a day for about a year, and I'm now, to now 4 years later, still calling 1 person a day. I don't like it, but he's very good. He lets me off after about a minute or two. And I don't know if it's that daily 1 minute is just because I'm following somebody else's direction, or if it's the plug into the program. I don't know what it is, but it's a tremendous help. Again, it's, I don't know why, but it makes me feel better. I'm solid. I'm doing something that is working. I don't know why, but it is. And one of the benefits of that is I mean, I still don't phone people. If I can text them or email them, I will. But I have an 80-year-old, kind of like a mother. My mother died, and my father, he's actually dead now, too. But anyway, she's really the only person that would be like a mother in my life, and she doesn't really know how to do email or texting. So I would never have called her in the past, but I have since then, because I knew that it's nice to call. My partner, Kathy, phones her mother every day, and I'd always go, my God, how do you do that? Get that. Just, what do you talk about? Because it's not 1 minute, it's like a half an hour, 45 minutes. Because I developed this pattern of calling this guy every day for a minute or two, I could call her, and now I call her probably every 2 or 3 days for 10 minutes. And I can do that now. I could never have done that before. When her husband died 20 years ago, I couldn't even call to say I'm sorry. I mean, you know, it's like, that's a big change in just that period of time. So AA, as I say, it's done for me things that I couldn't have intellectually figured out or figured out in my own Vera recovery program, which really I don't recommend. When I'm in a position where I advise people, I really, if you notice, really strongly suggest the 12-step program, along with the other stuff. Okay, so that's sort of what happened in my first year, and now what it's like for me now. AA, I mean, it's an ongoing process. I have made a lot of changes. I think that one of the things that I have now, and this is really thanks to AA, is a sense of fellowship in a way that I never had before. I have always been drawn to alcoholics. I mean, I grew up as one. The friends that I had when I left home were all, that was what we did. It was like our lifestyle. And then when I went into university, I didn't like the non-alcoholics. Like I said, they were boring. Then when I got into my work, when I worked with just regular people, I just found them really boring, and found that I constantly was wanting to work with the alcoholics and the addicts. And the only person it's an anomaly, is my partner, who's not an alcoholic or a drug addict. And I think that one of the things about that is it's like my place of sanity that I need to come home to. But anyway, other than that place of sanity, I do like the insanity. So, but you know, the really great thing is I work in this field, and now I'm in AA, and I get to be on the good side of that insanity, not the bad side, the using side, but the sober. But we're still nuts. But you know, we get to still be part of that, but the clean side of that. It's actually, I think it's like having your cake and eating it too. So the fellowship has been really important to me, because I also was a very private person. I was very used to listening to people and their stories, but not used to sharing back. I mean, part of it is the role that I was in. It's totally inappropriate to say, "Yeah, me too." You just don't do that, and you certainly don't do it with your colleagues, because it's all about everybody's just real keen and really good, and it's very competitive, and nobody talks about that kind of stuff. So I was pretty isolated. And when I came into AA, I could listen to people, but I could also talk. And that was a really important thing, because one of the things I discovered was those secrets that I had, some of them were precious, and I didn't want to talk about them, because talking about them meant I would almost have to let them go. But then I discovered, you know what, it's nice to let go of some of this stuff. It's really nice to let go of some of this stuff. Some of these things that I've been holding on to, embarrassments or things that I've done, even just about myself, who I am. It's really nice, and the more I talk about it, the less horrible it is, the less weird it is. So that was another benefit that I wouldn't have known, and I have in terms of the fellowship. And then just the fellowship of just a community of people. I mean, I used to go to churches and various groups to try to find some kind of commonality, and I didn't get that anywhere until I came here. The other thing that I'm a real timekeeper. So it's that German part of me. Oh God. Yeah, that's got some good and bad sides to it. Okay. There's a couple of other things I want to say about where I am now. Another thing that I've gotten from AA is an understanding of my expectation of, you know, the big payoff. Throughout my whole life, and alcoholism feeds into this big time for me, it's about do work, do what I got to do, but I will always get the payoff. And I know I'll get the payoff because I can arrange it. I just pay whatever cost it is, 13 bucks or 20 bucks or whatever it is for that bottle of wine or whatever, and I know what's going to happen. Like I said, it's the next three and then the drunk, depressed thing. I know that. I could control that, and that was my payoff. Having to give that up, it has been probably the biggest struggle after that first year. I'm not going to drink anymore, but where else am I going to get the payoff? Well, now I don't eat anymore, and I don't smoke cigarettes anymore, and I don't, well, Jesus, how am I going to get the payoff? I don't do anything anymore. And that kind of mental concept of wanting the payoff has been really hard to let go of, because especially as an ambitious person, it's like it's all about, if I'm going to do delayed gratification, then I want it at some point. If it's not now, it's got to be later. And one of the things that I've learned is the payoff comes, it just doesn't come on my terms. It may not even come in the way that I planned it. It's just going to come. And that kind of random payoff universe is really hard to take. I've had to do a meditation just to cope with that one. But, I mean, that's the whole idea, is to accept the randomness of things. I mean, I realize then that there is a payoff. I don't have to make it happen, and that there is some relief in that. But it's still a struggle to accept that. So that's sort of my present project of this year 3 and 4. I want to end by saying that I think the biggest thing that AA has given me is, and where I am today, is a sense of gratitude about just being alive. When I was, as a sober person, when I had that sobriety just before I came in, like I said, it was like the fox eating the entrails. I mean, you think about white-knuckling it. It wasn't, white-knuckling it had already passed. It was past that point. It was like, I don't care. Like, that sense of yes, I might kill myself or die or something like that, that was better than the other. Now I feel like I have all those same things, you know, the job and the house and the this and the that, and but they are not ends in themselves. I saw from that experience that they can't be ends in themselves. That was so disappointing. But what they are means towards service. So what AA has taught me is that fellowship is really, I mean, I feast on it. It's like it's mother's milk or something. Often I say it's like my daily bread. Fellowship is really important to me. But I think the thing that motivates me now and gets me to move is my concept of service. And in the past, I would have thought I need to do things in order to justify my life, because otherwise, you know, why should Vera be alive? But now it's more like, which is, you know, I guess it's good. It gets me out there doing things, but it's depressing. This is more, I get to do things, and I'm so grateful that I'm in a position where I can do things. Because when I do things, what joy there is in the interconnection between what I'm, me and the other person, or me and the, or in the job, or whatever it is that I'm doing. I don't know how to say it other than that it's a sense of joy. To be able to give something and to have it received. And I do want to say that for those people who are new and are thinking, I don't want to call somebody or I don't want to bug people, you are giving them a gift as much as they're giving you a gift of time. It's a mutual love-in. It's a win-win. It's a win-win. And it's a win-win that I'm so grateful that I can be part of. And AA has given me an opportunity to do that, because I can help, you know, a suffering alcoholic, or just learn how to smile during the day, and you know, as opposed to being self-centered or something like that. It's just the idea that service is a really valuable and joyful way to live, and that's sort of where I think that's probably. That sense of meaning is something that AA has given me that today makes me feel a joy of life. It's still not necessarily the payoff, but it's a joy of life. So, with that sense of gratitude, I just want to end. I mean, this conference is called the Gratitude Conference, and you know, Thanksgiving is a time of feasting, and you know, we're all here to feast on what we can from. What AA can give us. I just want to say I'm really grateful and honored to be able to speak here tonight, I hope I can impart that sense of gratitude. I feel so, every morning I wake up and I say thank you that I am in a position where I can do some kind of service, even if it's just being nice to the barista at Starbucks, doesn't matter. Just some kind of service, because that makes me feel joyful. And on that note, I'll end. Thank you.